And next up on Free Radio, it is Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the Sunday, December 10th, 2017 edition. We have interviews galore and hopefully sound quality that you can hear. Apologies for last week's show, I should say for last Thursday's show, which was a little hard to hear and a little ancient, but today it's going to be all modern, all new, and hopefully all hearable. So I may not go through all these interviews. We're talking interviews with Mike Zint of Berkeley, Brent Adams of Santa Cruz, Turbo of the Marina area, Wes White of Salinas, and more. Ray Lynn of Marysville, the Red Church Gang, lots of voices from there, Rhonda of Santa Cruz, and, well, stay tuned for all the stuff and you'll hear it. Enjoy.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of breadlines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you.
And welcome to another edition of Bathrob Spears Broadsides. Reminding you, of course, you get $500 if you let us know where we can find a 10x10 studio space in Santa Cruz somewhere with electricity, internet, and toilet access. Yes, $500. Give me a call at 423-4833, area code 831. You have to essentially get it for a year, but you'll get a little bit less money for every month that we are able to be there. You'll be paid on a kind of prorated basis. I'm going to begin now, and I've got a really packed show, so I'm going to be breaking this up with a bit of music, but hopefully not as much desultory commentary as usual. This is Mike Zint up in Berkeley. Recently spoke with him. This show is recorded on a Saturday before the Sunday when it's broadcast, so don't be confused about the time frame. But listen in and, wow, learn, because Mike is, assuming what he's saying is accurate, and I can't really vouch for that. I haven't researched everything he said, but he certainly believes it, and I haven't heard contradictory claims about what he's been saying in the past, so let's hear what he says today or on this recording, and, well, you be the judge yourself. Okay, well, it's Saturday, December 9th, and I'm on the line with activist Mike Zint up in Berkeley, California. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm indoors. That's good, and so are you at the moment, but I understand they're trying to shuffle you and activist Mike Lee out of doors. We talked about that. I want to hear about that, but I'm also very interested in hearing about what's happening with the various iterations of first they came for the homeless encampments up there. So begin wherever you want.
Well, as far as the latest developments with me and Mike Lee, I don't really have a lot of information on what's going on with Mike Lee, but it looks like the hub which is Berkeley Food and Housing, has raised both of our rents to half of the checks that we get every month. Now, my rent that I paid just last week was $268.71. The new amount is, I believe, $448. Let me see here. Yeah, $448. So they raised it $160 on me. And I have no reason for this. They gave no explanation for the increase. And it's very curious that my increase and Mike Lee's increase came at, you know, pretty much the same time, which appears to be just a few weeks after we filed the lawsuit.
And remind listeners who hadn't been around what this lawsuit was.
The lawsuit, it's a class action lawsuit against the city of Berkeley, where the judge is requiring Berkeley provide a plan to house their 600 homeless. And what Berkeley did was, it was kind of like they went against what the judge asked. The judge was very specific, and he wanted a plan, not stuff that was already in place, but what they were going to do, a new plan. And it looks like what Berkeley did was they just submitted what they had in place. You know, and the judge, I wasn't in court to witness it, but I don't think the judge was very happy with what the city did.
And the judge didn't really require them to actually provide anything other than a plan, and he also asked the people who are pressing the lawsuit, the plaintiffs who were trying to defend the first they came for the homeless folks.
They wanted our plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and they did. They got it. I understand that Dan Siegel is suggesting a bunch of encampments. I think he said 25 encampments that would handle the homeless situation. And we also asked the city to identify properties, possible properties. That has never happened, you know, as far as I know. We have a property list. The city has like a master property list, and I don't think they quite match up.
Hmm. So, first they came for the homeless, then called Here and There, which was the camp at the locus of at the edge of Berkeley and Oakland on Adeline Street.
Yeah, it's at the Here and There sign, or it was. Now it's all messed up.
And it's kind of moved across the road with the, I guess, the deportation, eviction, whatever, by the BART police based upon the death of a homeless person at another nearby camp.
Actually, the lady who died was not homeless. She's a housed mother from Oakland, which kind of deepens the whole mystery as to what she was doing at the second encampment. Hmm. And I still don't have a confirmation on cause of death. You know, of course, the paper says drug overdose, but I did not see that source through the police, so I don't know.
Do we know her name?
It was published, but I don't have the information handy.
And regarding your rent raises, have you determined whether anyone else's rent, other than you and Lee's rent, was raised at the same time?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
The whole thing about this letter, I mean, you saw the photo of the letter.
Yeah.
That is literally all I got. Just that little tiny letter stating that my rent increase is happening on January 1st. Now, one of the things, when I took this apartment or this studio, they had mentioned the possibility that the rent would go up to 50% of my check, and I told them, if that's going to happen, then I don't want this place because I can't afford this place. You're just going to make me homeless again. And then, you know, I'm not exactly sure what their end did, but my rent did not go up. And I've been here since April 20th. Now, Mike Lee moved in September 11th. So how is it that my rent did not go up for all those extra months, and then Mike Lee just went up within just 3 months? So it's very questionable that it just happens that both of us get this rent increase at the same time. And as far as possible reasons for my increase, it's only possible, because I'm not sure. I have a retro check that came in. You know, I just started getting my SSI 3 months ago, so I had a retro check, which my retro was a total of 6 months back pay, minus my general assistance, which came to about $1,800. So you take 900 times 6, and you subtract $1,800 from it. Now, that's what my total retro was. I think it came to like $4,800 for that at that point. And then they divided that into two checks to send me. Now, the program that the hub has, man, has a $2,000 maximum limit for money that you're allowed to have. If you go above that $2,000, then they will raise your rent to a 50% level. Okay. Now I've got mobility issues, extremely serious mobility issues. I can't move. So when I got my retro check, I'm sitting here with, I think I had $3,200 at that point. I'm not exactly sure. But I wanted to use that money to purchase a few things for my household, you know, and I started buying stuff for my kitchen, you know, like an expensive juicer and some other things, you know, and I think I spent the money down to about $2,200 when the hub came in one day and asked me how much money I had. And I told them, I said, I got about $2,200 left, you know, out of my retro check. And, you know, the thing that came out of their mouth is, well, you have to get that out of the account. Now, you got to get it out or they're going to raise your rent. Here, sign these papers stating that you only have this much money. That's what they did to me. And I'm sitting here looking at the situation going, if I sign these papers, which I did because I really had no choice, if I sign these papers, then I'm committing fraud and I'm jeopardizing my housing by doing so. Okay? So I sat there and I didn't realize when I signed those papers, and this was from the manager, one of the managers of the hub, she was here at my house, you know, and she explained this stuff very, very basically, you know, and they pretended like they were trying to protect me from a rent increase. So, you know, I was cool with that. I appreciated that they were trying to look out for me and they had an understanding of what my money was. But the next time they came out, I believe it was on the 9th of the month, the first question that came out of the worker's mouth about the money was, how much money have you spent on your household this month, okay? And my answer was $500 because as of the 9th, that's all I spent. I paid my rent and I paid my electric and I think I paid my phone bill. So it came to $500 and I still had $400 left to go grocery shopping and to pay my internet. And I got another bill. Netflix. So I had that money set aside for that. But to answer their question honestly is what I did. I'd only spent $500. So that could have been part of it. And another thing is when Sarah, my worker, was here, she saw my SSI paperwork that stated my retro check was like $6,500 or something. And she's like, you can't have this money. She didn't read the entire paper. She saw this number and automatically assumed that that was a factual number that I had someplace. And it was in violation. So that's a possibility. Then the other thing that happened is I'm now refusing to sign those papers. I'm not going to sign a paper that I know is not accurate. These papers about this retro check and about this whole situation, now this is what we were telling or trying to explain to the city, that this is what happens when you're homeless. The first thing they do is they put you into a situation, and it's like they force you in. Because your choice is, well, you get the housing or you stay homeless and miserable. So that's the choice they give you. Of course, you know, everybody's going to take the housing. And then now that they've got you in the housing, then they want to inspect your house. I did not understand that that was part of the program.
Let me interrupt you for a moment, Mike, to remind people that you have been working with this group, if not one of the co-founders of First They Came for the Homeless, for years, and you've been involved in, essentially, you were part of the group that was moved from place to place or moved itself.
I'm the founder, and I'm the organizer. I'm the guy behind all of this.
And the the police repeatedly tried to bust up the camp or at least disperse it from its current locations, 15 or 16 times until finally it was allowed to be on the edge of Berkeley until, I guess, October or November, thereabouts? And
yeah, I don't have dates.
Right.
It was recently that they allowed us to stay there for about 10 months.
And also you became quite ill. I mean, you have medical conditions that put you in the hospital. We actually talked to you in the hospital at one point. So you really needed housing almost as a life-threatening situation if you weren't ill.
I need a plug.
Yeah.
You know, it's the temperature in my house is the same as it is outdoors because my windows are broken. Okay, I'm living in a house that it's got broken windows, and I just got my latest electrical bill or my heat, my gas bill, PG&E. It went up $40 because I had my heat on for 3 weeks. This is an increase that I have to pay that the hub is not taking into consideration. And if correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not exactly sure, but a broken window in a house is a violation of building code and habitation code?
I suspect so.
Why am I in this house? It didn't pass inspection. There's no way it passed inspection with that window broken. I know this. Yet the hub had this house inspected before I moved in. By the way, my roof leaks about a gallon every time it rains, too, all over my kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And these are things that I've complained. I can't even take out my trash. My nurse, who I finally got after 6 months, the whole reason I couldn't spend my money is because they never got me my nurse. They never got the paperwork done. So I sat here for 6 months rationing my food, begging for rides to go grocery shopping and to pay my bills. And I finally ended up being late on my rent one time, and that really pissed me off. So the hub finally gets me my nurse. And within a week of my nurse starting, I'd spent $900 of that saved money on my household, just like I had expected to. You know, and there's still a couple of things I want to get. I want to get coffee tables, for God's sakes. I don't have any coffee tables. I got a couch. Okay, I have a couch and a desk. That's all I have in my apartment, and a bed that's up against the wall because there's no place to put the bed. You know, I want to get room dividers to divide my house up so I have a bedroom that's private. Oh, no, but I can't do that without the nurse.
So it looks, Mike, like they are, from your perspective, and it may well be, you're getting punished for your political activism working with First They Came for the Homeless in such a way that it may even be life-threatening for you.
It's a possibility that that's what is happening. Yeah.
What is happening with the rest of the First They Came for the Homeless in Campa, though? Because, you know, wretched as your conditions are and the stress is put on you, those folks are outside still, and presumably...
Well, those guys are actually having a little bit more fun than I am.
Ah.
You know, see, here's the deal. When you're homeless, you already have the homeless, you know, all that stuff going on. But when you're housed about to become homeless, you sit there and you wait to be homeless.
I understand.
Wait to lose everything. Literally, everything I just bought is in jeopardy right now because if I get a storage unit, I wouldn't be able to pay the bill. I wouldn't be able to get to it to pay the bill without begging. You know, and these are things that nobody took into consideration about my case when, well, not the hub, when they sat here and they just proceeded with their normal whatever.
And we can regard this as not merely a case of special pleading, but an example of what faces others in your situation. But let me get back.
Yes.
Let me get back, however, to the situation, because I'm interested in an update on what's happening with the folks outside. Do you have any reports on that?
Yeah, man, these guys are doing great. Okay, now we've got three camps. We've got a camp still at the Hear There sign, and that one is in place there because of two reasons. One is we're protecting the porta-potties that we're paying for. Okay, Friends of Adeline and First They Came for the Homeless has come together. We did a couple of fundraisers, and they have money for, I think, another month, maybe 6 weeks, maybe 2 months.
How big is that encampment?
Well, those porta potties were put in there by Berkeley for South Berkeley, even though we're paying for them.
Right, but how big is that encampment?
I believe there are 7 people in that encampment. And the other reason that encampment exists is because of Diane. She is the senior with Alzheimer's, and she comes and gets picked up by her family, and they take her home, and within a few days later, she comes back to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not going to leave her vulnerable. We're going to have personnel on the ground where she knows we're at so that she can come back to us until we get the situation resolved.
What about the other two camps?
The other two camps, man, Sam out at Aquatic Park has taken it upon himself to put in power plants into each of our camps. I don't know if you've seen the photos. We've got solar power. We got solar power like houses have. It is incredible. We got these. I think the panels at City Hall are they're like 6 foot tall. You know, they're 3-4 foot wide. These things are huge, and they're hooked up to batteries, so that each camp has their own ups and downs. Aquatic Park has a setup, and City Hall has a setup right on our front lawn, which is probably irritating the mayor. But yeah, and I think that is just one of the really, really cool things about the way this these camps are set up. Because we're doing self-rule, because each camp is being run individually by the occupants of the camp, we've got three totally separate communities going on right now. Each one is unique. Each one has its own problems. They are each facing their own challenges, and all the groups are overcoming their challenges. One step at a time, they're handling the problems that they're facing, and they're doing a lot better than anybody could ever have given them credit for. Nobody would have thought that these guys could do this. You know? But the truth is, and this is something that I've noticed about being homeless, is the homeless people, just to survive, just it's a basic life, day-to-day life, they think outside the box on a regular basis, and they are problem solvers. They have to be to survive. And that's what I'm seeing these guys do, is they're solving their problems. Now, there's a couple of major problems that need to be solved. City Hall, occupation, encampment. We started it with half a dozen people. There are probably 30 people out there right now, most of whom are not part of First They Came for the Homeless. They are just local homeless. Most of them are drug addicts, and they're there. And we're sitting here, we're watching the situation develop, knowing full well that these people are on drugs. I mean, I know these people personally. And I'm sitting here, and I'm concerned that these people don't get a solution because of the drugs. They don't get what we have because of the drugs. And I've advised City Hall to move the camp. You know, I'm like, look, guys, you can't have the drugs and the alcohol there because the police will use this against you, and it's tactics. It has nothing to do with the individuals who are doing the drugs and the alcohol.
How long is it?
Allow them.
How long is
allow them in?
How long is how long has the camp been there at City Hall?
Since they raided here, there.
Good, a couple
it
months.
Moved. It's been about a month now.
And would you say the behavior of the has there been bad behavior by the folks
no.
at City Hall?
No, there's been much respect. Here's the deal. Mm-hmm. These addicts know who we are. They know what we're doing. They know why we're doing it. And because we did it, we took all the heat last year. You know, it was 17 raids over 3 months that they hit us. During that time, they hit Gilman, I think, twice. Maybe three times. And then we took all the heat so that they didn't get raided and arrested and harassed and all that. And then the raids kind of stopped. Now, I don't know if the mayor has raided Gilman since all this, you know, since last year when he got elected. I've heard that he has not. And if that's the case, you know, good for him, but bad for him at the same time, because those people are just left out there to die. Literally, they're left out there to die. There's no solution for them. Now, we just met with a group called Safe Open Spaces, or SOS. Included in this group are people from the village. There were some people from Coalition for Homeless. There's an Alameda County employees. He's in the mental health division. They're developing a program to bring psychiatrists out to the camps. And First They Came for the Homeless is now getting involved in this development. Paul Blake, the commissioner for mental health in Berkeley, is going to help advise, stuff like that. These are new things that have not been discussed with our groups. But I told the SOS crew if they could solve the issues with six particular people, one of them being Diane with the Alzheimer's, another one being Crystal, who had to trade sex for rent, you know, who's at City Hall right now being protected. We've got a couple of addicts that need to be helped, and we've got a couple of mentally disabled people that are just very difficult, and they need advocacy. They don't understand what's going on. So if we can help these people, then we can help just about every homeless people out there, and let's just simply deal with them one at a time. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to get one of the tweakers that's at camp to try to sit down and talk as clearly as possible and explain what would it take for him to get off the drugs and to move forward in life.
I'm a big fan of the season. I like this time of year when everyone's out shopping, drinking lots of beer. When folks are taking holidays to visit mom and dad, telling jokes and stories about good times they had. But when I leave the house to go almost anywhere, I find myself accosted, and now it's more than I can bear. So to the scum who run Clear Channel, I must offer this review. If I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. If I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. Well, I like going sledding, riding in a sleigh. In fact, I might just take my kid to a good hill today. But if I hear those jingle bells ring one more fucking time, I might just lose my shit at Macy's and commit an awful crime. Next time I go out shopping, it won't be a pretty sight. When I hear one more person crooning about Christmas being white, I wish I could make Sinatra eat his goddamn you. If I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. If I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. I just just love those furry reindeer. And I'd like to see one fly. And I'd like to see a red-nosed one light up the nighttime sky. But all 500 versions of it make me feel so bleak when I have to hear each one of them 100 times a week. I don't care if it's a big band, rock and roll or what. Each time I hear that ballad, I can feel it in my gut. I start getting queasy, like I just swallowed Santa's tube. If I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. If I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. Now I'm sure Frosty was a good guy. He was made of snow. And I'm sure that the North Pole is a place I'd like to go. But if they play that song again on the radio, then there's something that seems only fair for you all to know. Next time I go out to a restaurant or walk into a store, it's quite likely I will make a big mess upon the floor. It will be an accident, but it will not be a fluke. 'Cause if I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. If I hear another Christmas song, I think I'm gonna puke. Happy holidays.
And that was David Rovick's Christmas Carol. Now it's back to Mike Zint in Berkeley. Don't go away. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM.
So what we're going to do is we're going to try to speakers that's at camp to try to sit down and talk as clearly as possible and explain what would it take for him to get off the drugs and to move forward in life. Now, I've done these drugs. You know, I was never addicted. That was just, you know, casual use. And I'll tell you right now, speed is crap. It's friggin' crap. So these people that are addicted to this stuff, they don't get an opportunity to do something else. Do you know what I mean? The drugs are everything to them. So what you need to do to break that is to replace those drugs with something, and that's what we're going to try to develop. And I think that needs to be done case by case. You know, everybody wants something different. Can we provide what everybody wants to replace the drugs? I think if we make them happy, I think they're going to get off the drugs, and that's what we're going to try to work for.
Any sense of what's going on in Oakland and San Francisco in terms of the large-scale, what do they call them, navigation centers?
They're a joke. Navigate to where? There's no affordable housing, so these navigation centers are just, they're in for 6 months or 3 months. I'm not sure what the time limit is in San Francisco. I think it's 3 months now. It might only be a month. But they're right back out on the streets to be harassed by the cops. Mm-hmm. That's all that's going on. It's a revolving door, in and out, in and out, in and out. You know, and they say, well, we've got this wonderful system in place. It's helping all these people. They don't tell you the whole truth. They only tell you a piece of the truth. And what Berkeley did is they were like, oh, my God, look at how wonderful San Francisco is doing. Let's duplicate their failed model. Oh, but they didn't use the word failed. Let's duplicate their model. And we're sitting there yelling at them, going, guys, they failed. Read the paper. It's in the paper, for God's sakes. And the paper is not nice to homeless people in San Francisco. And when the San Francisco press steps in and says, hey, guys, your navigation center is really messed up, there's really, truly a problem. And Berkeley was just like, well, we're going to follow San Francisco. And, you know, everybody wants to follow San Francisco. Don't follow San Francisco. They made it illegal for you to sit down. Okay, seriously, you're following a city that made it illegal to sit. That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
However, the navigation centers presumably are a step up from places like the Hub, right?
No. You need to go to the Hub to get into the navigation center. It's all part of the same thing. The thing about the Hub in Berkeley, the reason why it's such a problem, is because you have to go there to accomplish even a shelter bed. And these people don't give a shit about you. They don't even call you back or send emails. You go in, and they send you away. And then you go do what they send you away to do, and you come back, and they send you away again. And that's what they do, and they play this game to you for several visits.
I guess what I'm saying, Mike, is that the navigation centers are incrementally better than the traditional shelters that they replaced, or that
Yes and no. I had a guy inside the San Francisco Navigation Center telling me what was up, and he said it's basically the same thing. You do get a room, and you get roommates, which is a slight step above because it gives you some privacy and a little bit of security. But he also bitched about the fact that his roommate was sitting there shooting up dope right in front of him. And then he bitched about the fact that his roommate didn't know how to act, and then he bitched about the fact that his roommate was stealing his stuff. And these are the problems that the big shelters have. Not they're doing drugs in front of you. They go in the bathroom and do them or go outside and do them. But the thing is, you know, the security issues, the germs are still there, the bugs are still there. You don't get away from any of that. But you can have your dog with you, you know. And, yeah, that's a good thing. But it's like they're trying to make you, or they're trying to give you this little tiny bit in order for you to get into their system, which you already know does not work. The whole key is to get you into the system that does not work, to say, oh, look, we're helping. Give me more money.
And what's your sense of the, you know, the outside the system encampments that are under the freeways in Oakland and in San Francisco?
I think that without rules, you have chaos. You know, and everybody wants to say anarchy is chaos. No, anarchy is the absence of rulers. Okay, there's nobody in charge. That's why anarchy is so dangerous, because we don't need them. You know, and we've demonstrated that as a community of humans, we do fine without their leadership. We can take care of ourselves. We can make decisions for ourselves. You know, I don't need somebody to come in and tell me that I need to go be warehoused with a bunch of people when I have a tent that I've already purchased. You know, I own this tent, and it's in the commons. It's in public property, on public property, city-owned property. And I believe that everybody owns the commons equally. If I need the commons to stay alive, to give me the things that I need, then I want my tent. The shelter system is a joke. It does not give you what you need. The biggest thing you need is stability. Without the stability and gear storage, you need to have your gear someplace so that you can go function. Without those two things, there's no way you're ever getting off the streets, ever. You're just going to be stuck in the system like I am, where they put you indoors and then they kick you out. And then, you know, if you are as unhealthy as I am, then they make it look like they're trying really hard to get you back indoors. But the reality is there is no place to put me. That's why I'm in East Oakland right now, which is not a bad neighborhood. I'm not in a bad area. But it's so far out of the way that the people have to drive 20 minutes just to come see me.
Now, the tent cities that are, or the tent encampments that are around in Oakland, how are they doing in terms of, let's say, how the police are treating them, how the communities nearby are treating them? I'm not proposing them as a model for, you know, comparing it with First Aid Campus.
Some of them are excellent. I've been on the BART, and I've ridden past some of these encampments, and they're big. And I go by this one in particular. This thing is spotless. It makes me jealous. My encampments are not this nice. You know, and it's only got about 20 tents, and they keep this place immaculate, you know, and they've got gardening. And I mean, these people, they got it going on. You know, so it's not that it's all the encampments. It's what happens is people go to these encampments, to these gatherings of people for protection and safety in numbers. It's not easy for a cop to come in and raid when there's 150 people as when there's five. So they're grouping up, and the larger the group, the more diverse the personnel inside of that group, which means drugs and alcohol are going to be in there. You're going to have drug dealers in there. You're going to have crime. You're going to have violence. It's very difficult to maintain the security aspect in that environment. So that's the only drawback. But these people, they're, you know, you got thousands of them out there. I'm not seeing thousands of reports every day of problems. I'm seeing a handful of reports. Some are from NIMBYs and some are justified reports. You know, these complaints, I'm seeing some of them, you know, they're pretty bad. But most of them are not. They're not real. It's get them out of my neighborhood type complaints, the NIMBY complaints. So what Oakland has done, you know, with their little tough shed thing, you know about that, right?
Related for the folks who don't know.
Okay, so what Oakland has done is they've built tough sheds. And I will just go with this one in particular, this one group of tough sheds in particular. I don't know the number. I believe it was 40 that they put together. These tough sheds are for two people. So you don't get your privacy, and you don't get your, you know, security. security of possessions. I don't think you have control who your roommate is. So, you never know what's going to come in your door. So you have these are divided into two. They have been described as one step above a doghouse. And I'm sitting here scratching my head because I actually lived in a shed. I don't think it was a tough shed, but I did live in a shed for a few days. And, you know, it's better than a tent. It really is. It's more spacious and you can stand up. But it's not something that two people should share. It's too small. You know, my four-person tent is 56 square feet. Berkeley's plan for their Pathways project, the buildings that they're using they look like 20 foot by 40 foot with 25 people in. If you do the math, that's 32 square feet each person. So my four-person tent, which isn't costing a taxpayer a damn thing, is actually giving me more space and providing me more stuff. That's one of the things that we keep trying to explain to people. We're not using your resources for this, you know, but what they did in court, they straight up did this in court. They said, these 10 cities are using up our valuable resources that we can't dedicate towards solving homelessness. They said that. Now, that even made the paper. That's such a joke. You know, seriously, my tent cost me $60. That's it. I think my sleeping bag cost $90. So for $150, I have sheltered myself and provided myself with a bed. The only thing that I need is the 7-foot by 8-foot piece of grass to put my tent on. That's it. And that's not going to cost the city $1 million like their new shelter system that they're trying to put in place. They're actually $2 million. I believe it's $1.9 million. Now, what we're doing is going to cost the city a porta potty and a wash station and trash pickup. And that's it. And if you do the math on it, it will come to less than $15,000 a year to provide these services for each camp. That's way less than $1.9 million. And if we do 25 camps, you're looking at $325,000 a year, maybe, for 25 camps to get 600 homeless people off the streets. That is so much better than anything that they're doing. And the system, the program that we're using actually is working. You know, just the numbers of people that we've gotten into housing, we didn't pay to get them into housing, we didn't purchase their housing, we provided the environment that they needed to save their money and get their own housing. This is what we're trying to explain to people. We give them what they need, which is not much, and they do the work themselves. So, and every homeless person out there who is mentally capable and not seriously addicted is going to see this, is going to be attracted to this, and a lot of them want this.
Now, Mike, in the Street Spirit newspaper recently, there's been a lot of babble about tiny houses. And critics like Carol Denny, who's a writer for the Street Spirit, has been particularly sarcastically skeptical about this tiny houses proposal. Do you have any sense about how you react to that?
Yeah, well, it depends on which proposal you're talking about. If you're talking about Ben Bartlett's city pad proposal, that is a friggin' joke. You know, I appreciate Ben's effort to come up with a solution, and he's on maybe the right track. I do agree with the concept, and I understand what he's saying about density.
Clarify what the proposal is.
Okay. Ben Bartlett's city pad proposal is put in by, he teamed up with a developer. I can't remember the developer's name. Patrick Kennedy, I think. Anyways, he teams up with this developer. The developer goes to China and gets this, I believe, what they're called city pads. It's based on a storage container frame. And what they've done is they have assembled a house, a tiny house type setup on this frame. But it's made in China, so it's not real high quality. And it's also very small, and it's crap. Okay? But we're talking total crap. The display unit that they had at City Hall last year, the roof did not line up. It was crooked. And the steps were not level. Okay? Now, the other thing is, you're not getting a wheelchair inside that door. It's not ADA. So they can't even think about those. Now, the unit, brand new, if I was to buy one from China myself, it would cost me $26,000. That's it. Not a large purchase. What Patrick Kennedy wants to do is he wants to purchase these for the city, and he wants to charge the city for the next 20 years for each unit for a total of $250,000 per unit.
Well, we all should be Patrick Kennedy. I think that one of Denny's primary points is that there are no habitability standards for tiny houses, and hence there's no requirement that they meet habitability standards.
Well, wouldn't it make sense to put, if you're going to go through the effort of putting tiny homes in, wouldn't you just do it right the first time? Wouldn't you put a set of codes in there for these tiny homes? These are common sense solutions. I don't know why everybody's sitting here going, "Oh my God, we can't handle this." You know, people don't think anymore. They don't think ahead.
Well, Carol Denny's proposal was, she was in essence saying there's plenty of housing in Berkeley that could be used for that purpose. If rent profiteering were taken out of it, if the city, you know, made a commitment to actually house people in vacant housing or housing that's being kept for you know, speculative purposes.
Who owns the housing that Carol Denny is saying that we should get?
I think she's saying I suspect she's saying it's privately owned, but
it's privately owned and we're stealing somebody's property, and I'm not gonna go with that. If it's publicly owned property, if it's city owned property that the city is sitting on for future, then I'd say, yeah, let's get that piece of property. If it's housing or if it's a hotel or an apartment building, which they do own several of those, those are the things that we need. Those are the buildings that we want opened up and done to be turned into a shelter. Hell, the city just spent $6 million on the old wine storage facility, and they had the intention. And they sold it as, we're going to turn it into a homeless shelter, and then we're going to have a small section up for administrative offices. Oh, that sounds great. Let's approve it. So they approved it. Guess what? A month ago. Oh, well, we're not going to put the homeless shelter in. We're going to use the whole thing now for administrative offices.
It sounds familiar, Mike. I'm gonna kind of wrap it up, but I'll ask you to wrap it up and include whatever thoughts you want to say goodbye with.
Well, this new SOS group that's coming together, I'm kind of excited about being involved with them. I think that other people, and including Santa Cruz, somebody from Santa Cruz was supposed to be there or call in, and they were not able to. And you also were not able to call in because I really wanted you to be able to tell these people what was going on at the post office down in Santa Cruz. I don't think they're totally aware of the whole story in Santa Cruz. You know, but you guys are fighting it down there very similar to the way that we're fighting it up here. And I think if we all come together, and this is one of my biggest messages to the SOS group and every other group out there, look, we're not winning this fight. We're not winning. We've made progress, but the only way we're going to win is if other cities literally do exactly what we did, which is you go to a city-owned piece of property, you set your tents up, and I prefer City Hall because it's very annoying to do it at City Hall, but you go set your stuff up at City Hall and you say the same thing that we did. You know, this is our property too, and we have the right to take care of it. Well, I don't like using the word right. We have the necessity of shelter. Okay, and it is a necessity. If you don't have shelter, you die from the elements. And nobody has the right, no city manager, no city mayor, no city council member has the right to say that we are not allowed to take care of ourselves, and that's what's going on. And the only way that you're going to get this ability back is to fight for it. You're going to have to go set up your tent when the cops come. You're going to have to say, screw you. So literally, screw you. And then when they say, well, we're going to arrest you, and then they start grabbing your stuff, well, you grab your stuff first, and you break it down, and then you move to another location, and you set up again. And you keep repeating this process and repeating this process. And here's the fact. Every time they raid, it costs a ton of money. It's not sustainable for cities to continue raiding the encampment. So keep setting it up. Keep forcing them to raid. Do it drug and alcohol free. Use our rules, because those rules keep you protected. They really do. And just continue and continue and continue until the same thing happens to your city that happened in Berkeley, which is they have no choice but to stop. They're running out of money. It cost the city of Berkeley about $500,000 in 3 months last year to try to get rid of us, and they failed. So if every other city in the area starts doing this, and you don't need 100 people, you need 6. That's it. We started the Stub by the Hub with 6 people, and it grew to about 15. And those 15 people continue taking the abuse and getting beaten and getting arrested and getting raided for 3 months until the city finally stopped doing all these things. Now, if Santa Cruz was to do this, you know, I don't know what your new police chief is going to do. He'd probably go a little crazy because he wants to pretend to be compassionate, but I'm sorry. I know Andy Mills from
Tell me a little bit about that before we go.
Well, what Andy was doing up in Eureka, he had a bunch of good plans and he had a bunch of possible solutions, but he followed the property owners and the businesses because they've got the power. And he made the decisions based on their needs, not the needs of the homeless. And he's going to do that in every location he goes. Even if he wants to help, he's not going to be able to. And this is going to be the same with every police department out there because they only enforce the rules for the rich, not for the rest of us. So we have to fight the cops. We have to fight the cities. We have to fight the business associations. We have to fight property owners and developers, all to put a piece of cloth over our head. And I'm telling you, we need to start doing it now. 40% more homeless in Seattle in the last 2 years. 28% more homeless in Los Angeles in the last year. Okay, I'm looking at these numbers, and we don't have numbers for Berkeley because they did the count, and they counted my camp wrong. They literally, and it was a city council member who came out and counted my camp. Okay? She got the number wrong. So if they got that number wrong, how many other numbers are wrong? And when you find out that Sacramento, they've got their food stamp program that shows there were 12,000 homeless people using this program, and their homeless count was only, I think, 3,800 or 4,000, something like that. They got one in three. If these numbers are average, think about how many homeless there really are. And these are the serious homeless, okay? These are not the functioning homeless that can hide. There's no way to count those. You know, the couch surfers and stuff, you can't count those people. You know, and if they don't have a backpack with a sleeping bag attached, you can't tell they're homeless when they're walking down the street, but they're homeless. So what are the real numbers is one of the things that needs to be talked about. You know, and I'm telling you right now, Berkeley says, oh, we got 600. I'm saying, bullshit, you got about 2,000. Are you guys even going up in the hills and counting? No, you're not. Okay, you're counting Gilman because they're easy. They're sitting on the sidewalk. You're going to the parks, People's Park. You're counting them. You're going to Civic Center, which is now fenced off. And you're counting the ones that are on the outskirts there. You know, and then you came to us and you walked down the street, and it's only who you see. So as long as people think that homeless in Berkeley is only 600, they think that it's all, you know, it's something that's easy to take care of. You know, next year I'm expecting another 25% increase, and the year after that probably 50 to 60% because by then Trump's policies would have completely bankrupted the average American.
Mike, I'm going to leave it there, but I'm a little reluctant to because every time you open your mouth, I find it's I don't know how accurate it is, mind you, because I don't have the references in front of me, but I appreciate you bringing these things up, and I want to talk to you again if and when. And I also want to direct people to any websites or other places you think they should get more information about these issues.
Well, the only thing that we have right now is our Facebook page, which is First They Came for the Homeless on Facebook. We do pretty good posting from around the West Coast. We bring in some of the East Coast cities as well. But you get an idea of what's going on just by reviewing the page. You can scroll back and look at some of the articles. And I believe we're posting the numbers up there, including fatalities. Every time we find a fatality, we're going to be posting those because there's no accurate count on the numbers that die each year either. So my research last year got me to 42,000 in this country about died last year of exposure. If that's not genocide, I don't know what is. You know, and this is year in, year out. And as far as our webpage, it was done, and then GoDaddy took it down. I don't know why. But we do have firstthecameforthehomeless.org and firstthecameforthehomeless.net. But the pages are currently missing, so I'm still working on getting that fixed. If I have to, I'll redo the pages and put them up again in a couple of months. But those will have the history. First They Came for the Homeless is not just something that's been around for a year. We've been active since the end of Occupy SF. We are Occupy SF, but not using the name. We took the homeless occupiers from the JHP, Justin Herman Plaza, and the nine-month occupation of the 101, and that's what was what formed First They Came for the Homeless. It was literally 16 homeless people, seven of whom have now died. So it's this fight has gone from just, you know, a little bit more tents to, you know, our friends died to try to help everybody get tents for themselves, and our friends would not have died if they had those tents. And that's something that people need to understand. Yeah, a couple of them died of drugs. A couple of them died of alcohol poisoning. But every one of them died exposed.
Thank you, Mike. And we'll do it again.
Yeah. All right, Robert.
Take care, man.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Mike Zint up in Berkeley, hopefully keeping his housing and keeping us informed as to what's going on with folks who are hanging onto their housing by their fingernails and those who are outside in tents. Let's have another shot of David Rowicks.
The world has gone crazy, and it's all becoming clear when they're gunning down our comrades, and it seems the end is near. As they're loading up the launchers for the tear gas grenades, we can take off our bandanas and kiss behind the barricades. When it's madness all around, and you can see this at a glance, we will sing and we will cry, we will laugh and we will dance. As they shout their marching orders beneath the helicopter blades, we shall seize a moment for a kiss behind the barricades. They will try to break our spirit, and at times they may succeed, but our love for the world is stronger than their greed. When the building is surrounded and hope begins to fade, in my final hour, a kiss behind the barricades. As the movement grows, there will be hills and bends, but at the center of the struggle are your lovers and your friends. And the more we hold each other up, the less we can be swayed. Here's the love and solidarity, and a kiss behind the barricades. Lorna McKinnon, thank you very much.
And that was David Rowicks' Kiss Behind the Barricades. Let's turn next to the last meeting of the year of the Santa Cruz Shitty Council. Actually, it was the next to the last meeting. There was a Tuesday regular session, which was the last regular meeting. And then the next day, there was a rubber stamp bucks for the bumbuster first alarm folks, the thugs with uniforms who have run off or were actually part of the whole general program to run off homeless people from City Hall and the library area. And that's something I kind of want to look into and talk to you about. City Council on Tuesday had a long afternoon session starting, I think, around 12 or 12:30. Oral communication was shoved ahead till 5:30 rather than 5 o'clock, although they didn't notice it as such on the agenda program. Still, people who assume it's at 5 o'clock generally and don't rush to read the Mayor Chase's agenda, now it's Mayor Chiraz's because he was inaugurated or selected as mayor with Watkins as vice mayor. Some people don't read the agenda every time they think they can come during oral communications and speak at 5 o'clock. Not apparently on this occasion. There was only one speaker. Not that speaking much at 5 o'clock or 5:30 means anything. You get 2 minutes, even though there's plenty, it's supposed to be plenty of time, at least in terms of time allowed for all the speakers, that's half an hour. But Mayor Chase has made it a very rigid 2 minutes for every speaker, although if you ask for 5 minutes as a group, I have on occasion, she has provided that. Oral communications is the only time you really get to talk to the community through the medium of the televised city council meeting. Most of the rest of the time is taken up with the gabble from the staff and the back and forth from the city council itself. I'm going to play a little bit of the discussion of rent control and rent freeze, which the city council didn't really do, but and I'm not really sure how much of it they did because I was not there for that meeting. I'm getting less and less inclined to get down to those meetings. So I did make the oral communications briefly and then rushed off to a free radio meeting and then to the ACLU's forum, which also happened on Tuesday on hate speech, which I didn't spend too much time at. But let's look in on the city council. Let's begin with the city manager's report, which it seems like a kind of a dry place to begin. But Martine Bernal, the city manager, is, as I repeatedly say, the most important and most highly paid man in the city, at least in city government. And I've tried to play some of his remarks at a previous show at the Public Safety Committee when he talked about and defended his and Mauro Garcia's opening of the San Lorenzo campground, or at least making it legal. People moved there before it was officially opened and declared legal, and they've been there for years, actually, camping at night, usually hiding in the bushes.